Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to regularly achieve a feat that for most people is impossible? Ultra runner Scott Jurek has taken first place in dozens of races that run for at least 50 miles, including the 135-mile Badwater Ultra, the 153-mile Spartathlon in Greece, and he won the 100-mile Western States Endurance Run 7 consecutive years. Many fellow athletes are nearly as awed by his lifestyle as by his amazing record. Since Jurek has evolved over the years from a young adult who ate fast food several times a week to the purely vegan diet, he says has transformed his performance and his body. But as he reveals in his new memoir, the challenges he's faced in his life have rarely been limited to the miles he's putting under his feet, and his path to championship has been as much a mental and emotional journey as a physical one. The new book, written with Steve Friedman, is called Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
You write that your story is the story of anyone who has ever felt stuck, anyone who's ever dreamed of doing more and being more. Do you really feel like you're not so much different than everybody else?
Definitely. I mean, I grew up in northern Minnesota. I grew up out in the country as a hunting and fishing boy and not in a family of athletes. Grew up under a lot of circumstances that I think anybody might experience. So I definitely think I'm like, I could be anybody else.
Going back and writing this memoir, were you surprised at the places that you found strength, and did patterns emerge for you that you hadn't recognized before you set out to write it all down?
You know, I think with life, you just never know what it's going to throw at you. And the same goes with running an ultramarathon. I mean, there are things that you just never plan for. And I think that's the beauty of it too. It's always ever-changing, and you have to be adaptable and be able to think on your feet and react to things.
You start the book with this incredibly challenging race through Death Valley, and you're like 70 miles in with 65 to go, and you convey the sense that the mental challenge is at least as great as the one you're putting your body through.
Definitely. I mean, ultramarathons are really a test of mental strength and maybe something even beyond. I mean, the actual definition of ultra is to go beyond. And in ultramarathons, we definitely go beyond the physical body, go beyond the mind, and maybe tap into something else, a consciousness level, or, you know, some people refer to it as guts or soul. It's just, it's something greater. And I think that's what's helped me in life as well, just being able to go beyond certain levels that I never thought I could.
Do you think there's something unusual in that you need or want to continue pushing yourself and testing yourself in this way? There are people who will run one marathon and think, great, I did it. I can check that off the list. And clearly that's not the path you've taken.
No, definitely not. Well, I started right away pretty early after running my first marathon. A month later, I'm running my first 50-miler. I'm a dare from a buddy of mine. So it wasn't the typical path. But there's something unique about running an ultramarathon. I think for me, too, I'm not the fastest. I'm not the most gifted. I've got scoliosis. And on paper, I'm not supposed to be as fast. But the beauty of the ultramarathon is, the playing field gets leveled. And I think that's something that people are looking for. I think that's why you see so many people challenging themselves to a marathon. I mean, maybe they're not winning the race, but they're out there putting their body, their mind, and their soul to the test. And same goes with ultramarathon. People are looking for something greater. We're searching for something different from ordinary life. And you could definitely get that in other ways. People are choosing running right now. Running is really hot, and running is fun.
So you give us this beautiful portrait of your mother in the book, who particularly in the earliest parts of your life was this very vivacious presence. She had her own cooking show on TV. She meant a lot to you. And then when you were 9 or 10, she was diagnosed with MS. Can you talk about how that affected your relationship to your entire family?
Yeah, it's one of those things where, I essentially lost the mother that I knew as a young child, and for my brother and sister too, they didn't get to experience that as much. And so you basically experience somebody who's been so close to you being able to do so many things, and then all of those things are just gradually taken away. And some people have difficulty with that, or they face that challenge. And for my for my father, for my brother and sister, and even for my mother, it was one of those things where you accept and life moves on. But, I mean, it definitely made me into the person who I am today. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where I, you know, wouldn't wish that on anybody, but disease and struggle is something that a lot of families experience. And I could try to explain that in Eat and Run and how I got through that and how it's made me a better person today.
Yeah, you write about the fact that even as early as middle school, you had this sense that you had to be perfect. That's a lot of pressure to put on yourself.
It is. I guess, you know, growing up with a mother who, you know, in a lot of ways, she had achieved a lot. She went to college, and in her family and my father's family, I mean, nobody had attended secondary school. She expected a lot, as well as my father. And so growing up with parents who always told us to do our best and expected that, it wasn't something I guess tried to buck the system and avoid. I really embraced it, I guess, and maybe took it on almost too much, where, you know, I wanted to be perfect and wanted to do the best I possibly could.
You were still in high school when you met Dusty Olsen, who would ultimately have this huge influence on you as an athlete. And it's interesting. First of all, tell us about the first time you laid eyes on him, if you would.
Well, Dusty was one of these guys that, of course, my parents would not have approved probably of, because he had half his head shaved. He had the other half, you know, painted a certain color or dyed a certain color. He was a rebel, and he was somebody who, you know, our coach basically gave a ride to a ski meet because his team had left him behind because he was late, and he came on the bus, and yeah, he had this presence of, we knew how incredible of an athlete he was. We just all looked at him in awe, but also realized, like, wow, this guy's a wild man.
Well, we'll talk more about Dusty in a little bit, because it seems like in so many ways your personalities are polar opposites, and I suppose you just fulfilled a role for each other that you both needed at that time in your lives.
Definitely.
So your father is someone you describe as stern but compassionate. At the same time, he was under a huge amount of strain at the time that you were growing up.
Definitely. You're essentially, he was the breadwinner for our family, and he was working shift work. So he was rotating, you know, three different shifts, midnight, afternoon shift, day shift. And, you know, he was under a lot of pressure, and he was also losing, you know, a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, definitely takes its toll. And, you know, my mother, she was one of these individuals who didn't want us to know what was going on either. And we weren't a family that spoke a lot about what was going on. You know, mom just needed help. She was getting tired more often, needed more naps, you know, was weak, was dropping things, and just little bits and pieces. But, you know, our family wasn't, we just didn't talk about those things. She never wanted us to worry. You know, even later in life, she was always like, don't worry about me, I'm fine. And I think that was difficult.
Yeah, I think when your mom finally had to enter nursing home care when she was just 44, you write about the fact that she would say, I'm tough, I'm fine, which is really admirable to think about facing that at that age and being so brave.
Definitely. I mean, I draw a lot of strength from my mother because, yeah, and my father, for realizing like what they both went through. And she was somebody who just accepted, you know, a life that doesn't really have a bright future at all. If not, it's a very dismal future. And she had this, you know, presence and just her way of like being so humble and just so submissive to a disease and to an outlook of life that could have made her seem so different. But she found joy in some of the smallest and minute things that we possibly can. And I think that's what's made me appreciate in running when, you know, I'm out there and life is hard, both on and off the race course. It's like, gosh, look what she did and look at the approach she had to life. How can I put that positive twist on the situation that I'm dealing with, both on the race course and in life?
So your first love was not running at all, but cross-country skiing. What drew you to that sport?
Well, definitely the coach. I had an interesting coach. He was one of these Scandinavian Minnesotans who he was all about having fun. You know, exercise prior to that, you know, I love sports. I loved watching. I loved, you know, someday hoping I could, you know, play soccer or hockey and all these sports that I used to watch and admire. But he was one of these guys who taught me that there's fun in these mundane things such as running and, you know, skiing. And he just made it fun. And you know, he would tell stories of he and his brother, you know, going up to the Arctic and fishing and chasing down deer on foot in Minnesota. And so I think more than anything than the sport itself, it was that personality that captured me for sure.
I love the idea of chasing down deer on foot being something that people do for fun.
Well, in Minnesota, it's it gets a little boring. If you don't ice fish or if you don't snowmobile or if you don't play hockey, you find recreational activities that are quite unique.
So running early on, though, for you was sort of a means to an end so you could stay in shape to ski.
Definitely. I mean, Coach Sorensen, my ski coach, said, you know, one, after I skied my first season, which was like a total new experience. Never had been on skis like that before. He said, you know, this summer you all have to either run, bike, or roller ski, and you got to stay in shape. And for me, I didn't have a bike, couldn't afford one. Roller skis weren't an option. And the only other option was running. So I ran that summer. And I will say I didn't enjoy it. In fact, I loathed getting out there, and I experienced all the things everybody experiences, from, you know, cramps to side aches to having the runner trots and having to go to the bathroom while running. I mean, all of those things. But I wanted to get in shape for skiing, and that's what drove me. I wanted to get ready for Coach Sorensen and his plans for the next season.
What did it take to start to love running?
Well, it took a wild man like Dusty Olson, somebody who he learned from a lot of mentors on how to embrace endurance sports and realizing how much fun running could be. I mean, he took me out on trails and outside the city limits of Duluth and throughout the city, just deer paths that connected to deer paths to four-wheeler trails to dirt bike trails. And he, we would go up for 2 hours at a clip and just explore these areas. And, you know, he would throw mud at me and laugh and holler and scream and, you know, just hoot and holler the whole time. And it just was like this new twist on running I had never experienced before.
Yeah, when I think about Dusty, based on your description, I think of him sort of shouting at all times when in conversation with you, especially if you guys were in motion.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, he was one. And he constantly gave me a hard time. I mean, I won't lie. Like, there are many times, like, why do I hang out with this guy? Because he just, would throw just verbal abuse and joke after joke. And, you know, why am I hanging out with this guy, I would think. But he, you know, he just had a way of getting under my skin, and we could give each other a hard time. And at the end of the day, it just nothing else mattered. And just had this relationship where, yeah, this is what kind of happens, but for whatever reason, it was something I needed and maybe something he needed too.
My guest is Scott Jurek. He's an ultra marathon champion, including 7-time consecutive winner of the 100-mile Western States Endurance Run. We're talking this hour about his new book written with Steve Friedman called Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultra Marathon Greatness. We'll take a break here and return with more of the conversation. We'll also take your calls and emails. You can reach us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is ultramarathon champion Scott Jurek. His new book is called Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Scott, I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of your diet, starting with the way you ate as a kid.
Well, I grew up with a mother who definitely, she went to, believe it or not, college to teach home ec classes in high school and junior high. And so she cooked a lot. We grew up having a garden. We, as a family, would fish and hunt. I hunted a lot with my grandparents and aunt and uncles. I mean, it was just inbred in our family that, you know, hunting and fishing and living off the land. But then, you know, my mother brought, I guess, a domesticated aspect of the diet, and you know, with her, you know, new recipes she had when she worked for the Minnesota Egg Council. So, I ate well, but I hated vegetables as a kid, and in fact, all the way through high school, even into college, there were just a handful of vegetables. I mean, vegetables to me were corn, carrots, and potatoes. That was it. I mean, I had to plug my nose and count my peas every dinner, and just loathe every second of it. And so the fact that I'm where I am today, it's pretty surprising.
It's sort of amazing because you sort of rhapsodize about your love of kale in a way that I have not seen before.
I know. It's really a testament to how, you know, how we can change and, you know, what allows us to change or what like triggers us to change. So that to me is pretty fascinating because I think that's what life is all about. I mean, to go from somebody who hated running and hating vegetables to somebody who runs ultramarathons and now is a plant-based eater, it's pretty fascinating. And I think it's a testament that everybody else can do it no matter where you come from, because I was one of the most unlikely types to go in that path.
And your transition was gradual, which I think is interesting, too. You didn't, if you'll pardon the expression, you didn't go cold turkey.
No, I didn't. I gradually transitioned because I became first inspired to eat better because I had read a book, Spontaneous Healing, by Dr. Andrew Weil, and he's was one of the figures in the mid-90s of this holistic idea, and the body has its innate ability to heal itself. And I just kind of got interested that, okay, maybe I need to change things, because in college I was starting to eat fast food four times a week because now I had my own money and could go out to eat when I wanted to. And when I was working my job, you know, the fast food joints were right down the block in the mall, and I just would go and eat there all the time. And then that book triggered a lot of things, like I need to really maybe take a look at this for long-term health, seeing all the disease in the hospitals where I was training as a physical therapist, growing up with a mother with a chronic disease such as multiple sclerosis, and seeing all of that disease and sickness, realized like maybe there's something more, and that book really transformed me. But I didn't do it overnight. It was one of these things where I wanted to absorb more, I wanted to read more, I wanted to try new things, and so it was a gradual transition.
And in fact, when you were 12, you were diagnosed with high blood pressure yourself and had taken medication for some time.
Exactly. I mean, I hated doctors as a kid, and it was one of those things that I just couldn't believe. At, you know, 12 years old, you know, I'm basically, you know, revolting against my parents, the fact that I have to take medication. I mean, I hated shots, and the fact now I was needing to be on high blood pressure, and I won't ruin the story, but that was probably my first introduction to holistic healing, even though I didn't even realize it back at the time, and how I learned how to get control of my blood pressure and realize that it wasn't the fact that I had a heart problem or a cardiovascular problem. It was more the fact that I just was so wound up and stressed when I went into doctor's offices. So it definitely, you know, things could have been a lot different if I hadn't changed my diet, but noticed a lot of effects down the road in terms of performance later, and that was just a side benefit. My goal was to become better long-term as an individual and overall health, because I didn't want to get these diseases I was seeing in hospitals and seeing my mother go through.
Yeah, and you would see patients and you could clearly tell the ones who sort of took care of themselves with regard to diet from those who didn't.
Definitely. I mean, it made me appreciate, okay, there are so many pieces to health. And you know, diet is not a quick fix. It's not something that, you know, some people get drastic effects, especially if they're very sick or they have a severe problem once they change things. But for a lot of people, it's not a quick fix. So unfortunately, people try new diets and they get somewhat results or maybe see very little, but it's this long term. So for me, I was really in it for the long run, so to speak.
How did you feel your body changing as you eliminated all animal products entirely from your diet?
I noticed things like I was eating the beauty of the diet, it kind of, I guess, kept me down this path of, okay, these are the foods I can now eat. So I started to eat the foods that were richer in vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, so many of those micronutrients that I wasn't getting before. So I noticed things such as I had more energy. I bounced back from workouts quicker. I just felt youthful. I mean, my skin changed. I lost that 10 to 15 pounds that a lot of us gain in college because we start eating, you know, ways that we probably didn't when we were at home living with our parents. And so, you know, my muscle tone, you know, changed and popped. Just all these minute changes, but on a whole picture is realizing, gosh, you know, my body is feeling better than it ever had before. And it was key to my consistency in races and in training, because ultramarathoning is not just about luck. It's about really dedication, and that dedication was seen not only in training but also in my diet.
Yeah, you write about the fact that ultramarathoning requires extreme confidence tempered by extreme humility, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that for us.
Yes, you definitely have to, and it's the mental component of this sport, much like a lot of sports, where you have to have the confidence, because on race day, you can have done all the training. When you get to that starting line, if you're not confident, all that training could be wasted, because if you're in your head, oh gosh, how am I going to do this, and doubting yourself constantly. And I think that's very true with life. You have to go about life with a confidence, but at the same time, you have to have humility, because in an ultramarathon, you get to that starting line and realize, you know, you're going to be out on a course sometimes for 100 miles, sometimes for longer. Conditions can change. You can go from, you know, very hot climates. You can go to high altitudes. You can deal with all sorts of injuries and aches and pains and discomfort along the way. And those things, you have to be humble and respect beforehand. You can't go in, and I've made the mistake a few times, particularly with the Badwater Ultramarathon, thinking, okay, they tout this as the toughest foot race on the planet, and not respecting the course can leave you in a hurt, for sure.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is ultramarathon champion Scott Jurek, whose new book is called Eat and Run. Let's go on the phone now to Joey in Denton. Hi, Joey.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I was exactly what Scott is elaborating on right now. I'm one that has found running over the past couple of years, lost over 100 pounds in doing so, and, you know, implementing other circuit training in my exercise. But I've kind of lost that drive, and I felt as though I'd plateaued somewhat. And I was just kind of wondering what truly does keep him going. Is it, you know, just the drive to win the races, or is it just an all, you know, body wellness and wellness of the mind as well?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think it helps to have the goals. If I didn't have that goal of, okay, I got to be ready for the Western States 100 in June every year, if I didn't have goals along the way where I had, you know, training races or, you know, workout goals, those are important. But I think the big picture is important to recognize, because now that I've been doing this sport for almost 18 years, I need to realize, like, you know, this is something that's important to me beyond the races, beyond the accomplishments, beyond those little goals of getting out and running, you know, 8, 10, 20, 30 miles a day. It's really about something bigger. And so I would stress the importance, you know, find things that keep you motivated so that you can stay on track. Because for me, I'm always looking for new challenges. I also thrive off of learning from older runners that have wisdom of, you know, how they keep going. I derive strength and inspiration from the young runners. I hang out with younger guys that are pushing the limits, putting new twists on things. So in other sports, too, I really look at a lot of other extreme sports and people who are doing amazing things, and even other arts, whether it's music or just to realize, like, how do these people stay at it for so long? And just make it a part of a lifestyle. And for me, I probably won't be racing hardcore like I am now in a couple of years, but it's finding the things that will keep me interested in taking care of my body. So, yeah, I'd suggest try and find new things and put new twists on things to keep it interesting.
Of course, there are plenty of examples of people who run well into their 70s and even beyond. But I wonder about, for an elite athlete like yourself, how you approach the idea of the inevitable toll of aging, even if you take superb care of your body.
It's a tricky one. I mean, because I know there's only probably so many, I guess, ultra hard performances that I can mentally and physically take on. Physically, my body is in great shape. I think because I've taken care of it with, you know, looking at diet and strength and all of the components, rest, recovery, and just smart training over the years has helped. But mentally, more than anything, you know, there's a drive there that's hard sometimes. I look at these younger guys and think, you know, gosh, have I lost it? You know, and it's a hurdle to overcome. You know, how do I keep that drive? And, you know, in races, realizing, okay, when is enough enough, and how many more races do I need to win? Because I don't feel like I need to prove to anyone else or to myself that I'm worthy, so therefore I need to win. But mm-hmm. Why do I keep doing this? And I think that's the big question. I mentioned that in Eat and Run, you know, the big question is why, you know, and that's what I think I'm still searching for. But knowing that, okay, there's an importance here. There are two vehicles that changed my life, and I think they're important to continue from a health standpoint. But, you know, as far as races go, it's finding that drive. You know, what makes athletes come back from retirement and come back to the sport? A lot of times.
Does running feel like a choice to you, or does it feel like something you are compelled to do?
I think it was a choice, but it was, I guess, an opening in my life that I decided to follow. Yeah. And, you know, it could have been music. It could have been a career that would have brought maybe similar satisfaction. But at that moment, it was just something I grabbed a hold of and, you know, just went with it. And I didn't know where it was going to lead, what I was going to do with it. But I just had these individuals that led me down the path. Same goes with the diet. Having people to look up to be inspired, to, I guess, continue that free thinking and, you know, really, okay, how do I take all of these experiences and how do I take all of the activities and the people that I meet, kind of mold that into a picture? And I think that's kind of like life. You take all the little components and you make it into your own picture, your own experience. And that's what I did with running and eating.
We have an email here from Scott who's curious about your experiences with what's called the runner's high.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's no doubt I feel that. It doesn't get worn off per se after years of running. I'm still experiencing it, but I think there's the basic chemical runner's high that occurs. There's been a lot of research. There's been a lot of buzz, actually in the last 3-4 months about it. And it's something that does happen, whether it's endurance sports, whether it's, you know, arts. People experience those brain chemicals, much like they experience when they utilize drugs or other means to get to that point. But then there's something even deeper, and I think that's what ultramarathons get at. There's a recognition that you're on a different level of consciousness. And there are times when physically and mentally, I don't know how I'm going to get through a situation. And for whatever reason, I can still continue. And I've gotten through really tough challenges. And I don't know where that comes from, what that is, but it's something that I think is even greater than just that, I guess, primary level of runner's high or that lower level of runner's high. It's just going into another dimension. And I think that's what keeps me going back. It's like figuring out, gosh, what is that? And unfortunately, it doesn't last very long. Sometimes it's gone. And then, you know, I'm back to the normal world of, oh, my legs hurt. It's too hot out. But it's finding that and trying to hold on to it more and more.
Yeah, what is your relationship to pain?
My relationship to pain is there's a recognition that it occurs, and you know, I wish I could say Scott Drake doesn't feel any pain and run these races.
I wish we could think that too. We feel better for you.
But I do feel, the way I look at it is there's pain that's, you know, bad pain, say from an injury, and then there's the pain of discomfort. And I think pain of discomfort is something that we experience in life, whether it's emotional discomfort or, you know, trauma, things that happen. And it's not necessarily always a bad thing. I mean, I think pain and, you know, struggle breathe transformation and, you know, new beginnings. And the same goes with an ultra marathon. I can't look at pain as being this thing that I don't want to experience, because discomfort of my legs hurting is going to happen in a race. I mean, I'm going to feel that at some point. Ideally, I don't feel it as much. That's the goal. And I've learned how to go beyond the pain. So it's like having, for me, my definition of pain is different maybe for others, but as you practice something like ultramarathon and you learn how to, I guess, derive a new definition of that and look at it differently.
And I guess having to train in all kinds of weather, all kinds of conditions, you also need to find a way to embrace whatever nature throws at you.
Definitely. I think that's why I keep going back for the sport, too. It brings me back to that, like, primal way of being that our ancestors, whether just my great-grandparents who, you know, worked in the fields, or people who used to work, like, they got through those situations, or even before that, just struggling to stay alive with other animals on the planet. And how do you just stay alive? That primal kind of survival skills of paying attention to instincts and paying attention to the body and knowing, you know, what's happening around you, that I think is a beautiful thing. It's something that we in modern society don't have to deal with in the comforts of our home. So it's going beyond that and, I guess, dealing with everything that happens around me. That's what's thrown at me in ultramarathon.
My guest is ultramarathon champion Scott Jurek. His new book is called Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is multiple ultramarathon champion Scott Jurek. We're talking about his new memoir, Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I wonder if you can describe for us what it feels like to win a race and how long that euphoria lasts and how long the disappointment lasts if you feel like you haven't run your best or you haven't won.
Boy, yeah, and that's the beauty of ultramarathons. I mean, I wish I could hold on to that feeling I have, those last, you know, couple hundred meters as I hit the finish line, because it's like fireworks are going off. Hmm. It's like knowing all the difficulties. I mean, it's like any major milestone in your life when you've gotten through some tough challenge and realizing like how tough that road was to get there, and you get there and it's like, wow, just, yeah, it's like fireworks are going off in your whole body. And then after, you know, you kind of come back down to a level and realize, my legs hurt and I've got, you know, feet that are sore and I'm dehydrated and all those things, sunburnt. But, you know, those things remind you of just how great that experience was, even though it was, you know, as hard as can be during the actual event. And then, you know, when you when I don't achieve something, which has happened, you know, I've dropped out of races, and I discussed this in Eat and Run, how, you know, there are times when, you know, I feel like I have let people down, or I feel like I've won so much that when you don't win, it's difficult. But I've learned to realize that that's not what the journey is about. It's not about the destination. It's about all those experiences that you had on the race course as well as training. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, whether somebody's training for a half marathon, marathon, ultra marathon, or even a 5 or 10K or whatever fitness goal you have. It's really like all the things that you did along the way, and you wouldn't have done those things if you didn't get on that starting line and give it a shot.
How many hours do you run in a given week, typically?
I would say on an average, when I'm training for, say, a big event such as a 100-miler, I'm probably running in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 hours. So it's, you know, and then you throw in, you know, a couple strength workouts a week, hitting some yoga classes, doing the core work, some stretching, you know, and then throw in other things that you do as an athlete. It's a full-time job, and a lot of people do it, and they still have families. They have jobs, and we don't do this, you know, ultramarathoners don't do this because we want to make a big living out. In fact, it took me about 14 years before I could actually, quote, you know, make some money at this sport. Yeah, everybody out there, for the most part, you know, they hold jobs, and this is kind of like a hobby, and you find, you know, I guess some time to do it, whether it means waking up at 5 in the morning and getting in a run before work. But it becomes a challenge, but it's all worth it in the end.
You know, for so many people, the time that they spend exercising is the only sort of pure thinking time they have in their lives. And it seems like because of this career you've chosen, if nothing else, you have more of that unplugged time than a lot of other people have.
Yeah, I mean, that's the benefit, right? I think people do their hobby, their sport, as a way of, like you say, I don't know, unplugging, but I call it plugging in, because, you know, I'm plugging into something that I think we're losing. And, you know, Christopher McDougall speaks about this in Born to Run, and I've seen this in traveling around the world to races and remote places such as the Copper Canyon, and realizing that, you know, we want to plug back into those ancient ways. I mean, there's a lot of talk about that, and I think, you know, there's this happy medium, because of course a lot of us don't want to totally unplug from modern technology, so to speak. But running allows us to plug into, or allows me to plug into kind of those ancient ways of being, and realizing like now I'm part of nature. I'm not fighting it. I'm not in control. I'm at the whim, just like any other animal out in the mountains.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Tom on the line in Plano. Hi, Tom.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, first of all, much respect, much props out to Scott Jurek. I feel honored to be able to speak on the phone and just to ask a question to someone who's completed that long of a run. The longest run I've ever done is a half marathon, and was pretty wiped out after that. So my questions are, I have two questions, and they're kind of diverse from each other. The first one is, what are your thoughts on barefoot training to change the muscle groups up a little bit? And then the next question is just a little question about what you have to do to deal with the sun shining on you for being on the road running as long as you are. Do you carry sunscreen, or do you slowly build up a really good tan, or et cetera?
Thanks for your call, Tom.
Sure. Well, we'll talk on the first one. I'll take the second one. We'll talk about sun, since it's so hot in Dallas, and a lot of people are probably dealing with that in Texas right now in summertime. Essentially, with I use sunscreen in areas that get direct sunlight, such as the top of my ears. I'm a big visor fan to shade my face, and it still keeps I can still ventilate through the top of my head. Tops of shoulders are really key. But otherwise, I try not to use too much sunscreen. I utilize, like in Badwater, people can take a look at Eat and Run in the pictures in there. You know, unless I look like I'm in a spacesuit because I'm totally covered. In Badwater, it's actually a good idea. You want to shield yourself against from those hot elements, both the sun blazing down on you and then actually reflecting from the pavement. So I think shading yourself in ways, using sunscreen in susceptible areas, and I kind of got a little bit of olive skin in me from my my Bohemian heritage, Eastern European heritage, so I tan pretty well, so I get a little resistance from that. But definitely the hours out there in the sun, you want to protect yourself from that. And I utilize shading, sometimes sunscreen. On the other aspect, I'm sorry, the other...
The question of barefoot running.
Barefoot running, and do I utilize it, and what are my thoughts? Key thing with barefoot running, I think it's great, particularly as the caller mentioned, mixing up the muscle groups. I think it's great for strengthening. I do some of it on the inside of the track a couple times a week for a mile or two. I do it on the beach when I have a beach or sandy spot. I think it's great from a strengthening standpoint. And for some people, that's the way they want to run all the time. I say whatever gets you out the door and whatever gets you running is key. But for me, and for anybody who wants to run fast on rugged, rocky trails, you need some protection. Even the Tarahumaran, who I ran with down the Copper Canyon, they use 3/4-inch thick tire tread because you just need some protection against those stones. So I'm all for strengthening. I'm all for being in tune. And it helps you run better and definitely pay attention to your technique. So I think it's a useful adjunct. I look at it as like a cross-training for running, cross-training for better technique.
Can you talk about what else you learned running with the Tarahumara?
I learned probably the biggest lesson, without giving too much away from the book, that they're a lot like us. I think, you know, Chris points out that, yes, they are incredible athletes, and they are in touch with their bodies, maybe on a different level. But at the same time, they're thumbing for rides and picking up rides now as more and more roads are being built into the Copper Canyon. They're starting to see more problems with certain diseases as more and more Western ways of living and food. So I think the thing I learned from this, they're just like us. They don't quite understand the concept of recycling, however, and the fact that trash, as they took our Coke bottles, as they describe, and eat and run and toss them into the woods, they just didn't quite understand, you know, these things don't compost quickly like everything else they use. But what I learned is that they are all about efficiency, and for them, they're much like us. They're going to find ways of the path of least resistance, but what I learned is they're always resting. When we were on the trail, for instance, and hiking over with Caballo Blanco, as soon as we'd stop and take a break, they all just sat down immediately. Any time that we had a pause, they for them, energy consumption means calories, and in order to get those calories, you got to find food. So I think that was fascinating to just be able to walk with them for 30 miles and watch these individuals. They live like they did thousands of years ago. It was a unique experience they'll never forget.
Let's go next on the phones to Andrew in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Chris. Thanks. Hi, Scott. I'm a runner up to 26 miles, and what I can't fathom is, especially when I'm doing my long runs for marathon training, is switching to a vegan diet. Have you ever experienced people who've tried to switch and actually has backfired on them, especially if they're not as fastidious as you as far as getting the right amount of protein and so?
Yeah, it can definitely backfire because I think a lot of times people will just try to eliminate too much too quickly before you realize, okay, what else am I going to eat? It's real easy to say, okay, I'm not going to eat X, Y, and Z, but then if you don't have a plan or if you don't, what other things can I eat, or how do I navigate an airport, or how do I navigate a family or social situation where they may not have vegetarian or vegan food on hand? What am I going to do? So that can take a process. So I think it's always good just slowly transition and learn along the way, because I think so many people think, oh, yeah, this is the way I'm going to go. I'm going to try it right away. And then they're like, whoa, what am I going to eat now? So I looked at it as, okay, what can I eat? I don't look at it as an elimination diet. It's a diet of addition. So learn about new foods that you need to combine, particularly for the protein, because that can be the hardest. And I've been out in rural areas of the country where you definitely have to dig to find kidney beans or garbanzo beans from salad bars. Or for me, I travel with some protein powder. But it's getting over those hurdles and getting over the mental hurdle, too, because even for me, I describe this in Eat and Run, how I didn't think I could do it. Even, you know, the week before one of the biggest races of my career, Western States, you know, maybe I should have eaten meat. So, and that can be huge too. People have to understand you can get enough protein, you can eat well, you can feel energetic. You have to put a little effort. So like anything, if you're going to change your diet for the better, you have to put effort into it.
Let's go back to the phones one last time. This time we have Jay on the line in Dallas. Hey, Jay.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
And Scott, thank you, man. You know, one thing that I've learned from you is humility. I was the last person to finish Western States with you in 2000. And the fact that you won the race and stuck around to see me finish touched me beyond what I can say. So thank you, my brother.
Well, thank you. I mean, yeah, thank you for giving me that experience, because hanging out at the finish line, I draw so much inspiration from all of you. And I think that goes to say for anybody, you know, just even getting out and volunteering at an ultramarathon or any running event and just soaking in that energy, because getting to the finish line only lasts so long as somebody who is competing in the race. And just hanging out there, I get to soak in and see my brothers and sisters and those people who are out there experiencing all the things I experience, because we all go through the same ups and downs, and we all have problems out there, and we've all come through great struggles, and then we all come together and celebrate. So thank you.
How big a deal is it to have people along the sidelines at various places when you're running these races?
Oh, it's huge. In fact, the Ultra Trail Tour de Mont Blanc, which takes place in Chamonix in the Alps of France, Switzerland, Italy, I mean, man, there's nothing like racing a race in Europe over there, where just tons of people align the course, because in the U.S., we're out in the wilderness sometimes for hours before we see another human being, unless we see another racer. So it is fun, and I think it's also magical to feel like there's nobody else out there. So I like a little bit of both. As a competitive athlete who's racing at the top, it's really nice to have that encouragement and realize, okay, I kind of feel like, you know, at moments, this is almost like the Tour de France. And then other times I'm like, you know, I want it to be me and nature, and, you know, me within just those elements, and it's so there's no distraction. So I think that's the beauty of having both, and we get a good mix of that at races. It just depends on which race.
Do you struggle at all to get enough calories?
I don't. I mean, I even find it fun now, you know, after I've figured out more about the diet and how I can navigate. I actually enjoy having to hunt and forage, is the way I look at it, in airports, in fast food joints. You know, where can I find, you know, the ethnic food that, you know, in some of the toughest areas, and when I travel internationally, I actually enjoy that challenge now. So mm-hmm. to find enough calories, it really isn't hard. I think a lot of times when people go plant-based, they don't eat enough fat,
mm-hmm.
or you know, you can eat too much junk food too, but most of the time, you know, people eliminate protein and they eliminate fat, and you have to find sources for that.
Scott Jurek's new book is called Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness. Scott, thank you so much for joining us, and best wishes for continued success.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. He also picked up the phones this hour. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.